It's a little different screen than I'm used to looking at. I have a new version of Office on this little guy, and when it has a when it has a monitor or a projector connected to it, it does some oddball things. I'm going to see if we can turn out some of these lights up front. Try that. Okay. All right, we're doing cardiac disease today, and the heart suffers from all the basic problems of any other system, infectious abnormalities, autoimmune injury, rarely, but potentially neoplastic injury, things like that. Obviously, the majority of the thing when we think about heart disease, we're thinking about atherosclerosis, changes of hypertension, abnormal hypertrophy of the muscles secondary to hypertension, and things like that. And indeed, that is by far and away the bulk of the, see if I can get back on screen here just a minute. Come on, please come back. Who cares? All right. Hopefully, this thing is telling me the screen resolution isn't quite right. Well, we'll just hope that it's getting the... Because what happens is I lose the I lose my mouse guy here, my little cursor. Please come back. Well, all right. At any rate, the majority of disease of the heart then really has to, is depicted by what's going on in this picture here. And you've had some experience, I'm sure, now hearing about that from Dr. Bagley. What this guy is demonstrating here is the characteristic heart pain. And, you know, things are really bad. Here he's coming out of a restaurant bar, probably. They were probably drinking beer, God knows. Playing cards? What do you think? You think they were in there playing cards, doing all that kind of crap? Yeah. And he's dropped a cigarette here on the ground, on the snow, and is experiencing that kind of characteristic chest pain, which is not as characteristic as we would like to think. It doesn't always occur in the same place. And certainly for women, as you might be aware, pain can often be in the back, perceived as in the back, or not really painful at all. And most doctors now realize that when you're looking at women who have coronary heart disease and ischemic injury, such as a myocardial infarction that we see going on here, that the symptoms may not be at all like they are in a man. So, well, what we're going to be doing is working our way through the basic pathologies of the heart, but spending a good bit of time here with vascular-related kinds of things, problems with coronary blood flow. Now, when we really get down to what are the symptoms that we might see secondary to some problem of the heart, really, it's quite simple. It's just a handful of things that will give it away. One is that if there's not enough volume for the heart to work with, if there's a problem with blood loss, then there's not enough blood there to be able to push around, so the blood pressure goes down, and then perfusion to vital organs and so forth. Another one would be problems with the electrical conduction system of the heart, and in that situation, that can be pretty serious with arrhythmias occurring, even fatal arrhythmias. Obstruction to flow, maybe the heart does have enough volume to work with, and the muscle is strong enough to do the job, but if there are problems with the heart valves, that they don't open and close as they should, if they're scarred, or they've got crud on them and so forth, that will be an issue. Valvular issues in which you do have junk on the valve, and the valve, things may be embolizing away, inflammatory, infectious conditions and so forth where the heart valves are infected. And then lastly, which is probably the most common of all then, would be a cardiac-related muscle weakness. And that is generally due to poor coronary flow. There we go. Would be poor coronary flow, which is not clearly depicted, obviously, in that picture. We're going to start with some things that occur in utero during development. The heart has to develop early in the course of embryonic development because clearly you don't have adequate blood flow to the to every place. You can't really develop other parts. So cardiovascular system and a functioning heart has to come very early. And that development is subject to problems depending on infections and a variety of things that might be in mother's system that's going to get into the into that developing embryo. Now, we divide this from in a clinical standpoint, into two kinds of congenital heart disease. Congenital means you're born with it. I guess maybe it does suggest that it's genetic in nature. Vast majority of abnormalities, formation abnormalities of the heart, in fact, do not have a genetic background. They're developmental in the sense that there was too much alcohol at the wrong time, there was an infection with rubella or something like that at the wrong time. So most of them really don't have a genetic background. It occurs in sort of a normal gene set. But we make a distinction between whether the kid is blue at the beginning or the kid becomes blue later. And that is to say, if there is unoxygenated blood being mixed in with the systemic output, if the blood that comes back that should go through the lungs first is not, but is somehow coming across into the left side of the ventricle and is going to be coming out through the aorta, then we're going to have a kid who's blue right from the get-go because there's unoxygenated blood being mixed in with what should be oxygenated blood. The other cyanosis develops later. That's referred to as cyanosis. I mentioned that vessels are very important for development elsewhere in the body early on. That's why you want a cardiovascular system really rolling. Some years ago, there was a medication that was used to help people sleep called thalidomide. And you give thalidomide to people and they would go to sleep. The problem was if a mother was pregnant, one was pregnant at the time, thalidomide would impede the development of arms and legs. Were you aware of that? Do you know how that works? Yeah. And the reason that it didn't was it caused problems with vascular development. And if you didn't have good vascular development of the arms and legs, of the developing limb buds, then you never developed limbs in the first place. You know, we use thalidomide today for a lot of things. Do you know of an ocular application for it, or at least a congener of thalidomide? You know the things that we use for macular degeneration, where we're trying to shut off vascular growth, abnormal vascular growth in the retina, and we actually inject it into their eyes? You know about that, maybe? And what that's basically thalidomide that we're giving. And what it's doing is it's retarding that vascular growth. And because someone was smart enough to recognize what was going on, unfortunately with those kids that didn't develop those limbs, we now have basically a very effective medication for helping to slow down macular degeneration, at least in that proliferative period. Well, at any rate, so you have to have early development, so it comes along very early, and maybe a woman doesn't even know she's pregnant at this time yet. And so abnormalities can occur at that point. So genetic factors are rare, environmental factors are much more common that influence it, and we make the distinction between whether the kid is blue at the time of birth or becomes blue later in life, like 2 to 3 years down the road. We'll take a look here at some common abnormalities of the heart in which there's mixing of blood from one side to the other. And there's one I want you to kind of pay attention to, because why is it that a kid looks normal in terms of oxygenation of the blood initially, but 2 years down the road, everything changes? The heart anatomy hasn't changed, but what is the direction of flow has? Here's a pretty common thing right here. About 1 in 100 people have, which is to say someone in this room probably has this right now. In fact, 1 in 20 people will have a very small so-called atrial septal defect. The septum between the two atria normally closes off. There's an opening there in utero. It closes off, kind of like a one valve, it's kind of a curtain that hangs down on the left side of this thing, so that the that becomes two separate chambers after birth. About 1 in 20 people have a little hole. About 1 in 100 people have a pretty good sized hole between the two atria. So an atrial septal defect, pretty common. If it's small, it doesn't amount to anything. We really never even know about it. If it's good sized, this blood that's coming here from the left side of the heart can come back into the right atrium and then go back out the pulmonary artery and through the lungs and come back. And so some of that blood's just on a merry-go-round, and it never actually ends up coming out the left ventricle, because it leaks back across as soon as it comes back from the lungs. Here's a less common condition known as a ventral septal defect, and what this is showing is a hole here in the interventricular septum, Zunheit. And in that situation, because the higher pressure system over here on the left side, so the pulmonary side is quite low in comparison, When the left ventricle beats, the blood's gonna, some of this blood is gonna come over here. So it's also on a merry-go-round. It's constantly going around back through the lungs. But a good part of the blood does go out through the aorta. So the kid's pink upon birth. Okay. Here's what's called a patent ductus arteriosus. This is a little communication point up here. And again, that should close off the time of birth. Do you have a question?
Yeah.
No, they're not, actually. It's about the same in premature and full term. This one right here would also be where what we're looking at here, if you'll figure this out, is we're looking at what's called a left to right shunt. In other words, some of the blood in the left side of the circulatory, in the left side of the heart, shunts across to the right side of the heart. And so it constantly goes round and round. Some percentage of it constantly goes round and round and never really gets out into the circulation. That kid, because there's no mixing, the mixing occurs, but it's from left to right. And so there's no unoxygenated blood coming across into the left circulation. Yeah. Patent ductus arteriosus. This is the ductus arteriosus right here. As long as that's the case, the kid looks perfectly normal at the time of delivery. They pink up like they're supposed to. The problem now is that you have an overload of blood going through the lungs. There's too much pressure, too much volume. And the pulmonary vasculature is really not designed to handle that. And so it's going to undergo a hypoplastic change. The blood vessels of the lung are going to become much meatier. The muscle is going to increase in amount around the small arterioles, and we're going to see an increase in resistance. And so we see hypertension develop in the pulmonary vasculature. Well, after about a year or two of that, eventually the resistance in the pulmonary vasculature that has occurred because of the compensation, just has to compensate because of the increased pressure and volume, that resistance has become so great that this side of the heart has become much meatier. The right side of the heart, which is normally kind of thin, maybe 3 millimeters in thickness, and that's it, it begins to beef itself up, and eventually it becomes as strong as the left side of the heart. And when it beats, after about 2 to 3 years of that time, the shunt will beat itself. At a point, the shunt, we now see mixing of the right side of blood in the left. In fact, the pressure actually becomes greater on the right side than it does on the left. So now the shunt goes the other direction. Now, at the age of 2 or 3, they do any little bit of something and they turn blue, like they've got no oxygen in their blood. And what's happening is that right-sided blood is coming across into the left, and the left side now is going out through the aorta, and it's mixed with unoxygenated venous return. This reversal of the shunt's an important thing to understand. It has an eponym that goes with it. We'll look at that in just a moment here. So those are not terribly uncommon conditions, which involve mixing sometimes, but mixing of blood from the left to the right initially in time, if it's a significant amount of blood that's moving across, the shunt will reverse itself because of compensatory changes in the, just maybe sure I really do have what I, yeah, okay. Now, a kid may be blue at the get-go, and that is to say the kid's born and you expect the lungs to aerate and get going, and the kid's been working on moms, you know, oxygen transfer across the placenta. And what happens is that the kid never really gets pink. The kid's always a little bit blue. So what's going, here's an example how that will happen. This shows us a not terribly common congenital anomaly. There are three elements to it that are developmental and one that's compensatory, another that compensates for the abnormality. And so this is known as the tetralogy of Fallot. We'll take a look a little bit later specifically at what makes it up. But in this particular case, there is mixing of venous blood into the what's going to be the left side, and this non-oxygenated blood is going to get mixed in there, so it's going to come out in the main circulatory system. It doesn't mean that the kid has absolutely no oxygen. The kid's not going to die right there. It's just that it's decreased. And it's obvious they're kind of blue. So this would be a form of cyanotic heart disease where the kid is blue from the get-go, and the problem is that there is mixing of blood from the right side into the left side before any of that venous return, that right side blood goes through be lungs. So there's venous mixing here. Now, the other one is the tardive, and that's what I alluded to back on that first slide, what we call a tardive cyanosis. And this is where the cyanosis comes later in life, at the age of 2 or 3 or maybe slightly older. And what's going on, it's what I described there, and that is the business of initially there's left to right shunt because the left ventricle is stronger and so forth, but now so much blood or so much pressure is roaring itself through the pulmonary vasculature that there's hyperplasia of the vessel muscle in the lungs of the in the vessels of the lungs, leading to increased pressure, and eventually the shunt will reverse itself because the right ventricle becomes doggone muscular and meaty. And at that point, it takes several years for that to happen. That, by the way, is known as Eisenminger's reaction, E-I-S-E-N-M-I-N-G-R. Let's see where we have that here. We'll see it eventually. But anyhow, so what's occurring is that there is initially that left to right compensatory changes in the pulmonary vasculature, and after a period of time, now it goes right to left. And now we see unoxygenated being representing some percentage of the blood that's going out through the aorta. So it's the reversal of this shunt that kind of drives that. And the first three things that we looked at would be good examples of that. Okay, just to come back to it for a minute, atrial septal defects, very common. Go back and take a look at that first game, and we're in that. Atrial septal defects are very common. Like I say, 1 in 20 people, so we got at least 3 or 4 in this room who have a small, at least have a small atrial septal defect, and maybe 1 in 100 where it's large enough to actually transmit a blood clot or something across it, maybe an opening the size of a pencil. So probably one person in this room has that. Could be me for all I know. And it could lead to what we call paradoxical embolization. You know, if you have a blood clot in your leg and it's on the venous side of the circulation, and then it comes up through the venous return, if it breaks free or a piece of it does, it comes into the right atrium, tricuspid valve, right ventricle, and out into the pulmonary circulation, right? Am I right? Am I right? Right, right, am I right? I'm right, yes, okay. And so that's a pulmonary embolus. Now that pulmonary embolus is a good sized chunk, and you know, of clot. It's not going to be able to go through the capillary bed and come all the way out into the left side and then end up coming out the left side and causing a stroke or something. But they do, it does occasionally happen that way, where a clot that's on the venous side ends up coming out through the aorta and it never went through the lungs. And that seemed paradoxical. We refer to that as paradoxical embolization. And when that happens, we're looking at somebody who has an atrial septal defect. Clot comes into the right side of the in the right side of the heart, like one would expect, but it crosses through that opening and then comes out through the aorta and ends up causing a stroke and arterial embolization, which would seem to make no sense. How does a venous blood clot get into the arterial circulation and it never went through the lungs? Well, the answer is it didn't go through the lungs. It found a shortcut. And so about 1 in 100 people have that potential for so-called paradoxical embolization. There are a variety of repairs for this. If they're large, we really do have to do something about it. And you go in and you can actually sew it closed, or we can put a little prosthetic strip in here that will eventually epithelialize over. You have to be careful at what point we do that in kids, because the heart's going to grow, but that prosthetic piece of material is not. And so we just have to be sure what we're, you know, at what point we're doing that and how we're going to handle that. But sometimes you do have to go in and close these. This is a ventricular septal defect. And again, what we're taking a look at will be blood coming from the left side across into the right side of the heart. And it's going to set up that whole Eisenminger kind of thing, the possibility of the reactive increase in pressure in the pulmonary system, and then ultimately on the right side of the heart, and then a reversal of the shunt. Here's a picture of one. That's a pretty sizable one. What they've done is they've cut open the heart. We're looking here at the aorta. There's one of the coronary openings right there, aortic valve. And this right here is the left ventricle, and it's kind of been cut part of it over here. This is the mitral valve, and we're looking here at a really good-sized hole that, of course, goes across, the blood would have gone across into the right ventricle. Okay, let's see if I can get this thing to work here. I want to, will you play for me, please? The VSD is readily visible in the middle of the field. What are some of the long-term complications if this lesion is not repaired? Now, tetralogy fallot, as I mentioned, is one of those situations where the kid is blue right from the very get-go. There are three defects, developmental defects, and then one compensatory change. The three problems that I have and go on is, one, there's a ventral septal defect. There's a very narrowed and stenotic pulmonary outflow tract, which is what actually protects the pulmonary vasculature from that reactive process. The aorta is somewhat misplaced. It's sort of over the center, so that it's right over that ventricular septal defect. And the one compensatory change then is right ventricular hypertrophy. Because there's mixing of blood right and left, the right ventricle has to get real meaty because a lot of blood's being pushed through that through the ventricle, through the opening, so that the left side really pressurizes the right side. This is a representative of what we see, a very interesting thing here, so-called clubbing of the fingers, where these kids will get these very pronounced, they almost look like tree frogs with these great big blobs out here, and I have no idea why that occurs. We know what's going on, but we don't know how it is that this chronic cyanotic condition produces that change. We see that in people who have long-term lung disease, like emphysema and chronic bronchitis, by the way. At any rate, this kid is showing us that they're kind of blue or dusky looking. They've got these changes, and those are the three developmental things, and then the one hypertrophy is the compensatory change on the right ventricle. The lungs are actually spared the increased pressure because the pulmonic outflow is constricted, so you don't have the full pressure going through through that. If recognized early, I wouldn't characterize it as an easy fix, but it's a fix that can be done, and the kid has basically normal lifespan and everything. But that's an example of cyanotic heart disease. Now, what I mentioned before with respect to the compensatory change, I do want you to know I always ask a question of some sort about the tardive cyanotic condition. Oh, shoot. So I want you to appreciate what's going on with tardive cyanosis, meaning late cyanosis, and that business which name did not appear in here, and I apologize for that, Eisenminger, Eisenminger, something like that. It's in your textbook, you'll see it. But I do want you to know about that. another kind of congenital anomaly, which is not precisely located with the heart, but the aorta, is a so-called aortic coarctation. And there are a couple of places where we can have narrowing of the aorta. And here's an example of a coarctation. So the heart is missing from the diagram, but this is the aortic outflow. And we have a very narrowed area right here. Now, what this is going to mean is this person is going to die with heart failure. They're going to have terrible hypertension on one side, but not on the other. You see, downstream from this right here, the kidneys are probably down here in the basement. But at any rate, when we come down here past this area of narrowing, the kidneys, of course, are not getting the blood flow they would like. They want to have about 100 to 120 systolic, up to about 70 diastolic to do their job. And if they don't, they've got a mechanism for changing that, don't they? What do they do? What are the kidneys going to do if the blood pressure is not where they want it to be? Huh? Well, what? In order to be able to do the filtration, they need a certain level of pressure. They're somehow going to increase, not necessarily thicken it, but they're going to somehow increase the volume. And this is where that renin, do you remember renin angiotensin sort of thing? Have you heard about that, renin-angiotensinogen, yet? Okay, we will. The kidneys can elaborate renin, and they release that then, which in turn triggers the angiotensinogen 1, angiotensinogen 2, aldosterone cycle, and then you retain sodium. And you retain sodium and expand the vascular volume. And so what they're going to do is the kidneys will say, I will have a blood pressure of 120, and they'll make it happen by expanding the vascular volume, by having you retain fluid and make the blood volume bigger. What do you think the blood pressure is then above that narrowing? In order to have 120 on the downstream side here, what does it have to be above it? Much higher, yeah. And so it might be that the blood pressure for the heart in this area right up at here may be 200 over 110 in order to ensure that we have 120 over 70 down here. And so what will happen then is that the heart will basically give out. We'll see congestive heart failure. We may have a blowout of a cerebral vessel or something. But at any rate, that person's not going to live much past 30 or 35. And so it's real important that these are recognized and this is surgically corrected so that we don't have that narrowing there. The kidneys will go back to being happy and all the blood pressure will come back down. So it's a curable form of high blood pressure if you want to look at it like that. You want to understand the basics there of how and why the coarctation does what it does. Heart failure. I just used the term heart failure. I said this person who has this is going to die with congestive heart failure. What the heck does that mean? Congestive heart failure is looking at the inability of the heart, either because it's principally because of weakness of the muscle, to be able to push the blood around and keep the blood pressure up so that you can sit there and think and so your kidneys will work and everything else has good volume, flow, all the other organs do. So when we take a look at this and realize that in the case of whether the ventricle can work at all is really dependent upon a couple of things. One is, does it have the strength, as I just alluded to, or is there a problem with filling? Maybe the thing doesn't fill as it should. And so the muscle might be perfectly adequate, but you don't have enough filling into that left ventricle to be able to push the blood out. We use the term systolic failure to mean that the problem is one of inadequate pumping strength. Now, maybe there are the coronaries. Maybe you've got poor coronary blood flow. Maybe there's something wrong with the muscle itself. Maybe there's old, I don't know, maybe it's inflamed or something. But at any rate, most of the times it has to do with bad coronary flow or long-standing hypertension, and eventually the muscle just says the hell with it. That's a problem of systolic, of strength. It can't make a good contraction and squirt the blood out through the aorta. The other kind of failure we refer to as kind of backward failure or diastolic failure would be inability of the ventricle to fill. You see, if you had a lot of fluid or constriction of the pericardial sac, the heart couldn't dilate. If the ventricle can't fill, it doesn't matter how muscular, how healthy the muscle is. When it goes to contract, there's not a lot of blood there to begin with, to squirt out through the aorta. So we have diminished filling. You can have restriction of the motion of the heart, either because external factors such as fluid around the heart or scarring of the pericardium to the surface of the heart. The other possibility is that you could have something wrong with the muscle so that it can't really relax at all. That muscle has to be able to relax and the ventricle fill before you can have another contraction. So if you had scarring in there from old inflammation or deposits of protein that you wouldn't want in there that make the heart kind of rigid, it can't really go through a relaxation and filling phase. So then it doesn't really matter whether you got a lot of pump in terms of the muscle to squeeze or not. It's simply not going to push it out because it doesn't have very much to work with. So you want to understand the two principal mechanisms when we talk about heart failure. What we're talking about is inability to push adequate blood out through the aorta and maintain a peripheral blood pressure that makes everything work. You either have weakness of the muscle or there's a problem with the amount of volume that it has to work with. Does that make sense? Okay. Diastolic failure means we didn't fill it up. Here's sort of the classic example of congestive heart failure. And congestion means everything's full. All the ventricles are kind of dilated. They're full of blood. The lungs are full of blood. Everything is congested. It's not working right. And a classic example of this would be somebody who has fairly significant coronary heart disease. They've got atherosclerosis, but no plugs, complete plugs, but they've got diminished flow, so you have weakened muscle. And as the muscle is weak and the heart can't contract as strong as it should, it's got to be able to feed itself. You know, even though its job is pumping the blood, if it doesn't have good vascular flow to its to the muscle itself, can't do the job. Well, if it can't do the job, eventually the heart, the muscle begins to sort of dilate, and actin and myosin fibers begin to pull apart. And although you know about Starling's curve, that sort of jazz, where you stretch them to a point and it beats a little bit harder. No? Didn't you just have cardiac physiology here? Or, oh, okay. I thought I was coming after all that. Well, at any rate, if you tug or stretch the heart muscle a little bit, the actin and myosin, you improve actin and myosin overlap so that there's a better contraction. But you can stretch it to a point where you really start to separate everything, and then there really isn't a contraction or the crap. Well, in this case, what we're looking at here is kind of a dilated left ventricle. It just can't get it together and get going. And because it's got simply so much volume in it. And that volume then, and inability of the left ventricle to operate means it can't contract. The blood backs up into the left atrium. The blood backs up into the lungs, backs up all onto the venous side of the circulation. And what's being shown here is an elevated venous pressure. Your venous pressure is quite low. We measure it in millimeters of water, centimeters of water, as opposed to the arterial side, which is millimeters of mercury. Mercury is a whole lot heavier than water, you know. And what you've got is a very low pressure side on the venous side of the circulation, but everything gets backed up, and you will see that it doesn't move through the lungs well, and so the person is kind of dusky and cyanotic. We'll have fluid extravasated because of the increased pressure. It will basically overcome the oncotic pressure created by the proteins and so forth in the blood's flow. And fluid will leak out of the blood vessels, and we'll have edema, peripheral edema here, and things like that. Liver will be increased in size. And this would be an example. It's a very dilated heart shadow. It's much larger than it should be. All these sorts of things are indicative of poor left ventricular function. And if the blood can't get moved out of the left ventricle, it's going to back up everywhere on, you know, behind it. It's just like, you know, if you're coming back from the mall out here on 3rd Street, I've been at the mall and you're driving this way, okay? And somebody's in that lane by the curb, you know, and they're going to speed up and they're going to get in front of you before you get to the light by the fire station. You know which one I'm talking about out here, right? Are you going to let them in? Did they have any business being in that right-hand lane in the first place? You know, shouldn't they have been in the lane you're in because you know that they're going to want to come across? You know that? Or are they going to end up in the front yard of that person right there at the corner? Yeah, I know it's going to. Well, this is the same kind of thing. You got to get it all crammed together. Now, if it were all four lanes up through there, that'd be fine. And that's the sort of thing with the heart. You everything eventually sort of collapses into the one weak point, and the weak point here happens to be the, if you want to look at it, not like it's narrowed, but the weak link in the thing now is the weak left ventricle. Why is the left ventricle weak? It's weak because it's got poor coronary flow. Everything backs up, and all the cars then back up all the way out to the mall and to Nashville and Columbus and God knows where. Okay. Well, that's what's occurring here. So everything backs up. This is congestive heart failure. This is probably the most common form. The edema that's occurring peripherally as well as in the lungs in this person, the fluid that's being extravasated is basically depicted here. And that is that there's a hydrostatic pressure, which is the pumping line pressure, or the pump, the amount of pressure that's in the system just from, you know, the fluid volume. And some of that fluid is going to get out. Some of it then gets picked up by lymphatics, of course. But there's also an osmotic pull created by albumin and proteins like that that sort of pull to keep the water in the vascular system. And at some point, this pressure here becomes greater than the oncotic pressure to hold it in. So it's going to seep across. It's going to be pushed across. And you're going to end up with the changes we see here. Here you can see this is the increased pressure indicated on the venous side now, because the blood simply can't transit the left ventricle, and the end result is fluid being extravasated all over the place, in the lungs, in the soft tissue, dependent parts, you know, the down in her legs and so forth. That's what this is demonstrating here. As the pressure rises, then what we have will be basically extravasation of fluid from a failing left ventricle. Here's an example of pulmonary edema. This is looking at a lung showing all this frothy, watery fluid. This is certainly what Seymour Hoffman was dying with in his last few minutes here over the weekend. He had pulmonary edema from his failing ventricle because he killed himself with, opiates. You know who I mean, Seymour Hoffman? He's a hell of a good actor. The blood builds up in the liver, creates kind of a network pattern like this. Looks kind of like this nutmeg seed. Chronic passive congestion of the liver tells us that there's been chronic backup of blood in the liver. Here's the edema, showing you can kind of press your finger into that, and it stays, the divot stays, because it pushes the fluid out of the way, doesn't immediately fill in. So that's peripheral edema. Those are all signs of congestive heart failure, and congestive heart failure, for all practical purposes, is due to bad coronary flow to the left ventricle. Now, the changes, we would see very similar changes if the problem had to do with a filling defect. What we were talking about right there was systolic failure. And if it had been problems with inability to relax and fill, we still would have had blood all backed up because it can't get through. The point of narrow, if you want to look at it, is like that stoplight out here where everybody's got to come together in that one lane. The problem is still the left ventricle. Whether it's weak or it cannot dilate completely, the blood is still going to back up behind it. what we've been talking about in part here then, certainly with the common form of congestive heart failure, is ischemic heart disease. And I know this is something that Dr. Begley has talked about in the past, and that has to do with atherosclerosis. And with atherosclerosis of the coronary arteries, you can have several outcomes. We can either have an acute catastrophic occlusion, which leads to dead muscle. You can have a stress where you're asking the heart to do more than the coronary flow is adequate, let's say, to keep the heart muscle satisfied. And that may be perceived as pain or shortness of breath. Some perceive it as kind of an implosion. They describe it that way. And that would be angina pectoris, and that is where you don't have complete occlusion, but basically you're trying to get the heart to do more than it can, considering the amount of coronary flow that's coming through narrowed areas. Myocardial infarction, of course, complete occlusion, and then an area of muscle is going to die. We were just talking about chronic ischemia, and that is to say little bits of atherosclerosis here and there that reduce the blood flow will have a long-term effect in the form of congestive heart failure. And of course, a sudden death, arrhythmia, due to if we have a problem with having oxygenated blood to the conduction system, and the conduction system goes haywire and starts sending out all kinds of electrical signals, then you end up with basically a rhythm that is not going to be sustainable. This is showing the atherosclerosis, eventually you may have platelets aggregate or leakage of goo, leading to a complete thrombosis and occlusion. Again, we're going to take a look at a movie. Here we see a tight left mainstem coronary stenosis. Here's just an example of an occlusion leading to an area of complete ischemia or anoxia and the death of the muscle. Now, one of the problems when you have loss of the muscle, there are several things that are going to happen with myocardial infarction. That's what we're looking at here. This is a heart. Person has several old myocardial infarctions. It's been cut crosswise. So you have to imagine we had the heart out, we cut it crosswise, and we're looking at it like kind of a piece of sliced bread, you know, or something. Here's the left ventricle, big old meaty muscular left ventricle. Here's the right ventricle and right ventricular space over here. This up here is an acute myocardial infarction. It's about 7 days old. Person had it, they survived for 7 days, and then they died. Well, when you have, there's a fair bit of muscle that has immediately stopped working. So right off the bat, there's going to be a problem with moving blood because you now got, you just lost a substantial amount of your pumping capacity of the heart. So that's one thing that'll happen. Decreased blood flow here to the kidneys and everything else, backup of blood into the pulmonary vasculature and so forth, because the left ventricle just got a lot weaker because a bunch of it just dropped out. As the muscle dies and is being resorbed at about 5 to 7 days, this can be pretty weak. And what we see here is a blowout, one where in fact it ruptured and the heart pumped out the blood. Instead of going out the aorta, it went out through this hole. How much blood do you think you could lose if your heart suddenly developed a hole out here, the free wall? Would you pump out everything? Now think about it. The heart's contained in a pericardial sac. It's in a rigid sac. Does anybody donate blood in here? You ever donated blood? How much do they take off when you donate blood? Do you have any idea? Have you ever looked at that bag, see what's in there? How much? Not quite. It's about 450, 500. It's a pint, as we used to call it. It's actually not a pint. It's 450 milliliters. So we took off basically 2 cups of blood. Already? Pint, a pound, the world around, something like that. We took off about 500 cc's of blood. Did you keel over? They give you some orange juice and cookies. Yeah, and a little thing you could put up here that said, I gave blood today. All right. And you got up and went. Right back on. Yeah, okay. So he gave 500 cc's of blood. You'd probably give the same amount. I saw you acknowledge that. The person who did this loses 250 cc's of blood maximally. That's it. All they lose is 1/2 of the amount of blood that they will take off from you when you donate a unit of blood. He loses half. This person lost half and he died. So he didn't bleed to death, did he? So what was the limiting factor here? Why did they only lose 250 cc's? And then everything quit. Yeah. Okay, and what happened next? Exactly. What's happening is the blood is in the pericardial sac, and as it accumulates, it compresses the heart. So the heart cannot go through a diastolic filling phase. And then it doesn't matter how muscular everything else that's left is. If it can't fill, it's got nothing to pump out. We refer to that as cardiac tamponade. T-A-M-P-O-N-A-D-E. Cardiac tamponade, it looks like. What it means is the heart's squashed, and the heart can't go through a filling phase. So that's what happened here. Because it got trapped, the blood was trapped in that pericardial sac. Here, by the way, is an old myocardial infarction. Have no idea. Could be years old. See that white? That's a white area of scar. This is necrotic tissue. And you can see that hemorrhagic tract right through it. It doesn't follow a straight line path, but that's that. This is showing some of the pictures, and there are several in your book that show the progression of it. It'd be worth it to take a look at those. Just showing again elements of coagulative necrosis of the muscle. Remember when we use that term coagulation necrosis, it doesn't have anything to do with coagulation cascade. What we're talking about is the congealed proteins in the cells that died a hypoxic death. So that was what coagulation necrosis amounted to. What are the complications of a myocardial infarction? Somebody that has them, one's obviously pain, a lot of pain. One guy once described it actually to my wife, who was a nurse, said, it feels like I am swallowing a flaming softball. Jeez Louise, think about that for a minute, you know? We're talking some serious pain here. It feels like I'm swallowing a flaming softball. That hurts. Well, the pain is one thing. As we mentioned, you immediately have problems with capacity to pump because you just lost, you know, a substantial part of the flow into the left ventricle. Arrhythmias, if the blood flow, if it involves much of the conduction system, you can have dysfunction of papillary muscles of the mitral, principally mitral valve. the mitral valve muscles have to contract a little bit when the ventricle collapses on itself. If that doesn't happen, the valve starts to open. The mitral valve will not stay closed when the ventricle walls begin to collapse on themselves. And of course, later on, about day 5 or 7 is where this happens, the rupture and cardiac tamponade. So it's a pretty serious sort of thing. Let's see where we are here on this. We're gonna do this. You know what? This is actually a good place to stop, and we'll come back here on the hour, and then we'll kind of race along. I want you to see a couple of movies first, and then we'll just see how far we can get. I realize this is the only time that I have for it, so if we run short, I'll put a few things on when I get back to my office, but I think we're going to be okay. Okay, thank you. I'll see you on the hour, please. Yeah. Let me get this stopped here just for a second. Sorry.